You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book about The Price is Right and what the game show can teach us about real-life decision-making. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to an audience question about art perfect for road trip season.
We recently received a Wisconsin question from listener Chris Murphy from Madison.
My question is, why are there a higher concentration of outsider artist environments in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the U.S.?
Great question. WPR's Tim Peterson asked a few experts to answer Chris's question.
Nick Engelbert's Grandview in Hollandale, Wisconsin. The Paul and Matilda Wegner Grotto in Monroe County. These are some of Wisconsin's artist-built environments. Ornate, meticulously assembled artworks on a massive scale using concrete, glass, auto parts, you name it. Here's Courtney Anderson Kramer, a PhD candidate in the UW-Madison Department of Art History, who researches concrete sculpture gardens in the Midwest, like the Wisconsin Concrete Park in Phillips.
In general, a outsider art environment is going to be a space that is an artwork that is monumental in terms of its size and the amount of time that took to make, but also it can be monumental in the number of parts. So we're talking about the Wisconsin Concrete Park. Well, there are hundreds of sculptures on this site that the artist Fred Smith created over the course of decades.
Anderson Kramer says another example that was really influential on other artists in the region is the Dickeyville Grotto.
It is a monument to patriotism as well as Catholicism, and it is a sort of architectural grotto shrine that is encrusted with everything from geodes and rocks to Ford gear shift knobs, and the texture of the space is just stunning. It's like walking into a gem. It's beautiful.
Laura Bickford is an associate curator at the John Michael Kohler Art Center. She says this genre, like any art, is a cultural contribution and worthy of preservation.
These sort of art environments, I like to think of them as a genre-busting genre, where they're really made by people across walks of life who ordinarily maybe wouldn't feel that they were able to make works of art or wouldn't have access to a museum. And so they can really speak to a true way of the way that people are living on the land that they're living on.
And in the upper Midwest, in Wisconsin, in the early 20th century, people wanted to share their truth in the medium of concrete. And here's Anderson Kramer again.
At this time, you know, the 20s, 30s, even into the 40s, people are going, they're getting a bag of cement, and they're creating a garden border. They're creating a bird bath. They're creating birdhouses out of concrete. So it's very much a part of gardening itself, using the concrete in the garden to make your garden beautiful. It just so happens that these artists really were bitten with the concrete bug and just continued to grow in their confidence, creating sculptural spaces, architectural spaces, adding concrete to their homes.
But is Wisconsin a leader in this type of art? Anderson Kramer says there's not really a concrete answer.
There's some truth and some not so truth to that. You can find these sorts of artworks anywhere in the world, but there are organizations in the Midwest, especially in the state of Wisconsin, like the Kohler Foundation, that has done a great job of taking care of these sites. But then there is some truth to it that there are a lot here, and that's owing to tourism at the time. You think of around the 30s and 40s when these are being made, we're seeing lots of tourism to the Dells, to Door County, and homeowners are kind of capitalizing on this traffic, creating artworks that are driving people to their homes.
Laura Bickford says downloading the map called Wandering Wisconsin is great for navigating to these sites. Though, she admits, the best way to find them is to never take the highway.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on outsider art in Wisconsin, and a longer segment aired on WPR's Central Time. And that story idea? Well, it came to us from an audience question as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, in a new book, our next guest takes us on a journey to what he calls a strategic and mathematical wonderland. The Price is Right is the longest running game show in television history behind 60 Minutes. It would be the second longest running show period in its more than 50-year run. Thousands of contestants have had the chance to win big and small. Turns out there's a lot of math behind the games on the show, and that can tell us something about our own real-life decision-making. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch The Price is Right, or did you back the day? Have you been watching for years, decades? What are your armchair game strategies that you think would help you win? What's a mistake that you yell at the TV when Price is Right contestants make? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Justin Bergner blogs at Pop Culture Math. He's the author of the new book, Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. Justin Bergner, come on down. You're the next guest on Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. Pleased to be on the show today.
Now, you are a fan of math and how it plays out in pop culture. What drew you to The Price is Right?
Sure. Like a lot of people in my sort of generation, I'm in, you know, mid-40s. I grew up watching The Price is Right during, you know, summers and, you know, snow days. And when I went to college at Yale, I graduated with a degree in economics and mathematics back in 1998. And I focused on game theory on the economics side and probability theory on the mathematics side, which gel very well with the show. And I thought about attending, you know, graduate school to get an advanced degree in economics and focus on game theory. But I chose to enter the business world instead. And I don't regret foregoing the academic path, but I always yearned to leave my mark in the world of game theory, which came together with this book idea shortly after college. I started working on it in 2000, briefly when I was between jobs using VHS recordings. I then found employment quicker than expected and tabled the idea for the next 18 years, beginning it again in 2019. So ultimately, writing this book was a consolation prize to myself of sorts for not going down the academic path and an opportunity to share my love of game theory and probability theory with the world and with fans of the show.
And there's so much you write. It's a strategic and a mathematical wonderland. So much math and game theory behind the decision making on The Price is Right. Could you give us a sense of how rich this show is with this kind of thinking?
Sure. So, yeah, there are four major parts of the show, as, you know, viewers are aware. There's the contestants row bidding, where four contestants bid on an item up for bids, with the contestant who's closest to the actual retail price without going over coming up to play a pricing game. Then there are the pricing games, of which there are 77. Those are not game theory related because it's just you and the game. You're not actually competing with the other contestants like you are in contestants row bidding. Then there's the showcase showdown, where you spin the big wheel to get closest or exactly a dollar and one, or a combination of two spins, to decide which of the three players in the first half of the show and the second half of the show go to the showcase. And that's very much like a pure mathematical game theory exercise. And then there's the showcase, where the winners of the showcase showdown bid on attractive sets of prizes, usually valued between 20 and 40,000, at least back in a couple of years ago, seasons 47 to 48, which I use as a data set for my book. And that turned out to be a very sort of rich and interesting area for some conclusions as well. You know, ultimately, there's a lot of interesting math and game theory, but I would say that two-thirds of the improvement that contestants probably could create versus what's observed on the show is related more to behavioral shortcomings, and then the other one third is related to, you know, strategy and math optimization. So it's really a combination of, you know, behavioral shortcomings and, you know, mathematical limitations that cause contestants to come up short in different parts of the show.
Well, let's check out this key moment. It's going to happen, I believe, nine times in every show. The visit to contestants row, where people come on down. Here's a listen.
The sewing machine goes to whoever bids closest to the actual retail price without going over. Good luck, everybody. Wendy, how you doing? You're first.
$550.
Thank you, Christopher.
$699, Drew.
$699. Thank you very much, Julia.
$750.
Thank you, Sandra.
$751.
Actual retail price, $3,148.
All right.
Sandra, come on up.
Let's get into the game theory of contestants row six times per game, of course. This illustrates two things. First of all, the strategy of bidding $1 higher than the previous high bid if you're in that fourth position.
Right. So this example is perfect for a lot of the observations I draw in my book, because the three areas where contestants come up short is in underbidding on the item up for bids, mainly due to a fear of going over, but also just due to, you know, being more familiar with sales prices or the item being unfamiliar, like a sewing machine. You know, and secondly, there's this notion of anchoring where, you know, the first contestant to bid bids low and then the other contestants follow. And then third is this notion of, you know, broadening your bid to actually create a bid that when the dust settles, you know, captures a fair portion of the number line over which you could win over. So here for the sewing machine, you see a low first bid and you see the second and third bidders also bidding low. And then the fourth bidder just comes in and bids $1 over the highest price. And so, you know, if you look back over seasons 47 and 48, which was my data set, you know, 53% of the time, the highest bid won, and 64% of the time when the last bidder tabled the highest bid, as occurred here, that contestant would win when they were bidding in the favorable last position. Of course, the final bidder should always bid $1 or a couple dollars if they want to be nice over one of the prior bids, or if they feel that all bids have gone over, bid $1. So this example is really perfect for, you know, what we observe most frequently in terms of the bidding sequences.
All right, this probably means I'm a big nerd, but now, Justin, I want to see an alternate version where all four people make a sealed bid. You know, they write it down and reveal it at the same time and see how that changes the strategies. Like, how could that shake up the game theory?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very different game, even though it seems very similar. You know, in that situation, and I sort of briefly allude to it in my book, you know, what contestants want to basically do is, you know, choose sort of a random number within sort of the sort of call it lower, you know, maybe two thirds or three quarters of the reasonable portion of the number line. So it's interesting on the show, the first bidder who has very little idea as to how to bid strategically often just tables his or her best guess with call it a small discount or margin of safety, you know, not to go over. And that sort of is what you would expect sort of the average bid to look like in a sealed bid situation.
We're talking to Justin Bergner about his new book, Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Now, are you or have you been a fan of The Price is Right? Do you have a question about a particular game and the strategy behind it or thoughts on it? And outside of game shows, do you feel like you assess probabilities and odds in your daily life for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Justin Bergner, author of the new book, Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the show? Hey, anybody out there been on The Price is Right? Love to hear from you. If so, do you have questions about the strategies behind the different games and events on The Price is Right? Join in at 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Justin, we heard, you know, the that first thing that people do on the show, Contestants Row, people often guess low. There's consistent badness there. But on the Showcase Showdown, you write, where you spin the wheel, you're trying to get 100. You did the math on optimal strategies, and it turns out contestants actually just their gut instinct or whatever, they do pretty well at optimizing.
Yeah, it's interesting. They, you know, individuals have a pretty good innate sense of probability. It's probably, you know, an evolutionary selected trait. You know, the contestants, if you're bidding first, you should, you know, not spin again if you are 70 cents or higher. And if you're bidding second, you should not spin again if you get a spin of 55 cents or higher on your first spin, presuming you've, you know, overtaken the first spinner. And most contestants do pretty well. I mean, I think the second spinner might be a little bit too aggressive in spinning, not realizing they only have to beat, you know, one subsequent spinner, and the first spinner might be a little bit too conservative, not realizing they have to beat two subsequent spinners. But yeah, overall, most people make the right choice, and it leads to sort of very much, at least results that are very, you know, similar to a simulated, you know, set of outcomes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Cyril is with us in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hello there. I have another game show that also plays with numbers on Jeopardy, especially Final Jeopardy, where an answer is posed and the three contestants have to guess which is the right answer, but they also have to wager whatever portion of their current winnings to find out if they've wagered enough to win, because they have the highest total number.
Interesting. Interesting point, Cyril. Yeah, at Final Jeopardy, Justin, you've got to guess not just how confident am I that I'm going to get this right, how much to bid myself, but also how much are other people going to bid and how much are they think I'm going to bid? And then we're into game theory, right?
Right. No, it's a really good game theory question. I'm not, Cyril, thank you for the question. I'm not the expert on Jeopardy. I think there are some experts on Jeopardy that have either written a book or written sort of substantial sort of articles on how to best tackle the Final Jeopardy bidding. Very interesting show, very interesting game theory problem. But I can't say I'm an expert in it, unfortunately.
Cyril, thanks a lot for the call. Justin, there's so many subgames, and you write about them and strategies. What to you, as you started to break down the, you know, the one-off games on Price is Right, what was the tastiest challenge for you when it came to math?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of games that were sort of very probabilistic in terms of figuring out what you should do, like Let Them Roll, where you roll five dice with three cars on three of the six faces and $3 values in the other three faces, and you can decide whether or not to stop and take cash or roll again, or Spelling Bee, where you're offered cash, or you can go on and continue trying to spell a car, C-A-R, with the letter C-A-R. So there are all sorts of, you know, trade-offs in a lot of the car games as to whether or not to keep the cash or play on for the car, which, you know, become very specific probability problems. I think there are a lot of interesting games as well that speak to people's behavioral biases. So I come up with a couple terms for some of these. So like strategic patience, contestants in a number of games, including range game, that's too much in card game, tend to stop the price meter or sort of price in the process of increasing the price towards, you know, the value of the prize too soon. And most of the time when they lose, you know, whether it's an easy or a hard game, they end up losing by stopping too soon. I think that has a lot of interesting, you know, real world analogies to it.
You look for different examples like that, Justin, of examples in the game that might inform us in real life. You actually mentioned one earlier, the anchoring effect, where we have no clue what the number of something should be, a cost or whatever the number. Somebody throws out a number. It could be a random number, and that brings our brain into that vicinity. How important is it for us to be aware of those kind of biases in our mind when it comes to assessing values of things?
Oh, I think it's very important. I mean, it affects us in multiple aspects of life. I mean, the example that's most, you know, familiar to me as someone who's in the world of finance is, you know, buying a stock, it goes down, you wait until it comes back to your purchase price to decide to sell it, even though that's a completely arbitrary, you know, number that you're anchoring to. So it's something we're all very guilty of, some people more than others. And it shows up on the show like it does in lots of other areas of life.
Now, people on The Price is Right, you know, we could sit back and look from our TV, you know, the other side of the TV, and we're not under pressure, right? We're analyzing their decisions. How much do you think the excitement and maybe being on the clock affects people's ability to assess these things and make good probability judgments quickly?
Oh, sure. I definitely think it matters. I mean, in this notion of strategic patience or not waiting, you know, for the price to go up to the value of the prize in range game or that's too much, it definitely affects people on the show, but it affects people in real life when they have more time. I mean, in a personal finance decision, buying a house, we find a house we like, it's listed on the market. And instead of waiting, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for the seller to potentially lower the price and then negotiate against a lower price, we sort of get anxious and we act too soon. We negotiate against the initial list price and probably often pay more than we should for a new home purchase. So the time, I think, definitely exacerbates a lot of these shortcomings, but it doesn't mean that they don't exist when we have more time on our hands.
All right, just 20 seconds. I'm giving you the clock pressure, Justin. What game would be the most fun for you to play on The Price is Right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I like the game Hot Seat, where it's somewhat complicated, but you have to guess higher or lower for 5 items. And then based on whether or not you're correct in those guesses, you can win up to $20,000. It involves math. It involves knowing what the prices of the prizes should be. And it involves knowing when to stop and keep playing for more money. So it's a lot of fun.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Justin Bergner. His new book is Solving the Price is Right, How Mathematics Can Improve Your Decisions on and Off the Set of America's Celebrated Game Show. He also blogs, by the way, at Pop Culture Math. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the effort to pass a defense spending budget and some controversial provisions passed by House Republicans. And the Women's Soccer World Cup kicks off this week with the U.S. squad widely seen as the team to beat. We'll get a preview of the tournament. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a dairy market expert tells us what's going on with the milk surplus and why some farmers are dumping excess milk down the drain. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a hazing scandal led Northwestern University to fire its head football coach. We'll talk to a hazing expert about why groups engage in this harmful behavior and how to prevent it. First, Bloomberg reports that some Midwestern farmers are once again dumping milk down the drain because of a glut in the market. Last week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that roughly 5 truckloads of milk per week are being dumped into the metro sewage system there. This comes as milk prices are declining from an all-time high last year. We've got a dairy markets expert with us now for a look at the latest in the milk supply, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to know? What questions do you have about the ebbs and flows of the dairy industry? Do you work in dairy at a farm, distributor, or processor? What are you seeing? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Leonard Paulzien is the Dairy Markets and Policy Outreach Specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Leonard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, that's a dramatic image of farmers, you know, dumping milk out because they don't have a buyer for it. How common is this when we hit, you know, certain points in the dairy cycle?
So one thing that's kind of interesting right now is that, you know, it is definitely something that hits the headlines. And as we look at the numbers, surprisingly, we're not what I would say outside of the normal range of what historical milk dumping numbers are. But I think part of the reason that it's a little more, we'll say, front and center right now is that not only is it happening at slightly an increased rate than normal, but the prices have been so low compared to where they were just a year ago. So I think the two things coupled together has really brought the issue to the forefront for sure.
Let's talk about those high prices last year. Now, we had a very dramatic drop in milk prices at the first COVID outbreak. Schools closed, schools not buying milk for a while there. We recovered from that. What drove prices up to the high level last year?
So a couple of things that we were seeing last year that really led to these high prices were both supply and demand side. So on the supply side, we saw that in international markets, a lot of the countries that normally brought a lot of products to market simply didn't have the product that they normally did in the volumes that they usually would expect. So that means that while we in the US, even though we had high prices, we were still able to bring a lot of product into the international market simply because we were one of the few players. So even though our prices were higher, they were still clearing the market at those higher prices in the international market. So which really kind of helped to push up our prices. Meanwhile, on the domestic side, our cow numbers were roughly flat, and our milk production was more or less flat from the year before. So what's interesting about that is that we were showing signs of increased efficiency in the national herd, and we were doing more with less. Our cow numbers were slightly below the year before. Our production was more or less the same. So some of the reasons why we didn't see the increase in our national herd that we normally do when margins are high is because feed prices were so high in 2022. So feed prices in conjunction with high building costs mean that adding each additional unit or that additional cow to the herd became increasingly expensive. And I'm sure that a lot of folks out there also know that during that time frame, we were experiencing a lot of increase in interest rates. So between those three things, I think they led to enough uncertainty by the individual producer that adding those additional cows in the normal time that we would see wasn't necessarily a decision that they were making. So as you march forward in the calendar till now, we did see that as we'll say things settled down a little bit, even though they were still in a high price environment as far as feed and interest rates go, it didn't look like we were going to see that we'll say continued rate of acceleration in the cost structure. And then producers decided that it may be a good time to try to capitalize on some of that increased margin, add some cows, cow production. So milk per cow has went up. And that's really kind of on the supply side, what led us to where we are today, being long on milk with really efficient animals.
Talk to Leonard Paulzien, Dairy Markets and Policy Outreach Specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Extension, looking at high milk prices last year, now low milk prices this year. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about what's going on, your thoughts, maybe your experiences if you are in the business. Call 800-642-1234. Leonard, part of the story here isn't just the supply side, as I'm reading anyway, it's the demand side. Those businesses, the processors who make things like, you know, cheese out of this milk, they don't have capacity. There's nowhere for the milk to go. What's happening?
Correct. That's one of the major issues at the moment is that processors have been running at let's say capacity, right? Even over this last year of 2022. So as we get this increase in milk, there simply isn't a home for it. So capacity, by that I mean not only the infrastructure in which they have in a facility to process milk, but also in terms of their labor force. So the majority of processors that I encounter or that you hear through the grapevine say that they're maxed out as far as the amount of available workers that they have. They're always looking for looking to increase that qualified workforce, but it's been a struggle for them in order to retain that talent in order to increase their processing capacity. And additionally, during this same time, we're seeing that inventories of product are growing. So that means that while we might be long on milk, and even if in theory they would be able to get enough people to process their milk, it's not clearing the market. So that means that their inventories are growing of product. So even if milk is at a discount, if you can't sell the end product because there isn't enough demand, then it does get a bit hard to make that decision if you're a processor to continually bringing in product to keep essentially warehousing it in cold storage.
I want to hammer home one of the points you just made on labor supply in dairy processing. Governor Evers has said reduced operating hours at processing plants is part of this story. As you just mentioned, what are plants doing to try to recruit and retain employees to help clear at least that part of the bottleneck?
So I know processing plants have continual recruitment efforts going on and always looking for ways to be competitive in the marketplace. That's for sure. One thing that's interesting is I go to different conferences or interact with those folks. There's always a lot of discussion around investment in technologies that make either the job easier or able to have, you know, higher wages for the individuals that are working with that technology, right? So if they can take what once was done by 10 people and do it by one person through the advent of additional investment, you know, that's always a topic of discussion. One thing that's, I'd say, an additional challenge with making that decision is the current environment that we're in. And by that, I mean, not only is that a high interest rate environment if they're looking to invest in any of these technologies, but also if you're have a bit of business uncertainty in that you're, we'll say, more adding product to inventory than you know, having it go to the end buyer, that might make it a little difficult for processors to pull the trigger right away on making some of these investment decisions.
Now, we've been talking about labor in dairy processing. How about on dairy farms themselves? We've heard again and again, dairy farms often rely on immigrant labor, but federal laws often are more about seasonal immigrant labor on farms. Dairy, well, all year is dairy season. What is the labor situation looking like for dairy farmers themselves?
Yeah, on farm, it's very much the same. Finding labor that are, you know, available and willing to work in a production facility on dairy production, dairy farm has always been a challenge and continues to be. So with the advent of some technologies and things like this, some folks are finding ways around that. But again, even just like the processing side, when you decide to implement those technologies, there's always some level of uncertainty, but also a large level of investment. So when you do come to times like this, when market prices are low, it definitely puts a strain on cash flow. So I'd say there's no silver bullet yet, but there's, you know, a lot of folks trying different things. And dairy business is a hard business. It is 24/7, 365 days a year. So, you know, when you're looking to bring in employees, it, you know, you have to create that shared understanding and knowledge of the type of business that you're in and what it takes to be successful in it. That's for sure.
Talking to Leonard Paulzien, Dairy Markets and Policy Outreach Specialist for UW-Madison Department of Extension. We're talking about, right now, an oversupply of milk in the dairy market and long-term trends and cycles in the dairy business. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this works? Maybe what it means for you as a consumer of dairy products? Are you a dairy farmer, or did you or your family leave that business? It's a challenging business, as our guest just said. Or do you work on the processing side, making cheese? Are you filled to capacity right now? Are you looking for workers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up a conversation with Leonard Paulzien, Dairy Markets and Policy Outreach Specialist for UW-Madison Extension. Talk about a milk surplus in the dairy industry as prices drop. Processors, well, they're full up. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your personal observations if you work or have worked in dairy yourself. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Virginia is with us in Rock County. Virginia, hi.
Yes, I would like the others to answer questions about why they are preventing small towns in northern Wisconsin from enacting pollution regulations.
Virginia, you're breaking up, but I think Virginia's pointing toward a story. Some large dairy groups in Wisconsin, Manufacturing and Commerce, are suing the DNR over wastewater regulations, and also there are people are contesting local ordinances trying to control runoff. I don't know if that's part of your area, Leonard. Is that an issue you've been watching?
I'd say that maybe a bit outside of what we've been focusing on recently. I do know that as dairy processing facilities, a lot of their investment recently has been on, in the state of Wisconsin, at least, on wastewater processing and making sure that they're dealing with that in the most appropriate manner possible. That's for sure.
Virginia, thanks for the call. Sorry we lost your connection there. Joni joins us now in Watertown. Joni, hi.
Hi. My concern is with these huge dairy farms, these what they call CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, that are littering Wisconsin and other parts of the country, and they're producing too much milk. We don't need all that milk. We don't need all those cows. We don't need all that manure being spread all over the place and getting into our waterways.
Joni, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Leonard, the size of dairy operations, I've heard other guests have told me anyway, those middle-sized dairy farms, we're seeing fewer of those, maybe some smaller family operations, and then these larger operations that Joni is talking about. How's the size of dairy playing out?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. I think it comes as no surprise to anyone that dairy definitely is consolidating, right? And by that, I mean there's a fewer number of larger operations, and that rate of consolidation does not seem to be slowing down at all. Part of the issues, or part of the, we'll say, natural phenomenon of how that happens is simply by the inherent structures of a commodity market. In a commodity system like dairy is in, the ways in which you make profit are by increasing efficiency and by being able to capture a margin that the market has to offer you. So just kind of as a natural byproduct of that, a lot of times we do see consolidation in operation size simply because they're more able to capture those economic efficiencies of scale. So I'm definitely sympathetic to the argument and to the caller's question, that's for sure. I have no silver bullet answer for that, but I would say that as we do go forward in as the industry, I think it would be difficult to see that there'd be a large reversal in trend simply because that's where we are seeing a lot of these operational efficiencies come in is with the larger dairies who are able to optimize labor and to be able to implement new technologies a little faster, more readily than maybe some smaller operations.
Joni, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I've got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, when there's a surplus of milk, taxpayers subsidize the dumping of milk. When there's a lack of milk, the same taxpayers subsidize dairy production. Looks like, Matt says, taxpayers are on the hook regardless. Leonard, what is the state of milk dairy-related subsidies?
So I guess I'd have to have a little bit more information on the specifics of what is mentioned. I will say that, there are different insurance programs that are available for producers to be able to utilize as risk management tools. And there are, portions of those premiums may be subsidized. I'd say I'd probably have to have a little more information in order to be able to provide a sufficient answer to that question. I want to make sure that I'm directing it towards what they're thinking about. So my apologies there.
Sure. Well, I know, Leonard, in the past, there were these so-called counter-cyclical programs that, help dairy farmers stay afloat when prices dropped too low. I'm not sure how those have played out in recent farm bills. Is that something that, are prices low enough that a program like that might be kicking in now?
Sure. Yeah. One of the more, we'll say, prevalent programs that dairy producers are utilizing right now that has been able to provide some price support for them. Well, I wouldn't say price support, but at least some additional margin would be DMC, dairy margin coverage. And that's facilitated by the USDA Farm Service Agency, where a producer enrolls in a certain level of coverage up to $9.50 per hundredweight of margin. And by margin, that's defined as income over feed cost. So they take a calculated feed cost minus an all milk price in order to calculate that margin. And producers that do enroll in that, they do pay a premium in order to be premium per hundredweight for the hundredweights that they want covered, all the way up to five million pounds of production. So the thing with that program is that the first 5 million pounds of production is equivalent to about a 200 and 250 cow dairy. And then after that, as you increase in pounds of production, the coverage levels decrease. So when the program was created, it was designed to be able to cover, those smaller levels of production first before ramping up from there. So with that, one interesting point there is that as the farm bill discussions continue and come forward very soon here, I'm sure that adjusting or looking at some of the different components within that program will likely surface as well.
Let's go back to our callers. Jeff is with us in Fox Lake. Jeff, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking the call. I got a question for your guest on what do you think the effect of these programs that the state put in place several years ago? First it was 2020 and then it was 2030. Got these guys a lot of grants and technical assistance on expanding. And I think they kind of, in my opinion, they overdid that part. They got all this milk and now the processes aren't quite prepared to handle it. And the other thing I was talking about, as far as size goes, what does it look like as far as like the federal funding coming for these biodigesters? Guys who are big are ramping even bigger to make sure that they're going to qualify for the funding, federal funding, to get a digester built, where a small and medium farm won't qualify for that because they don't have enough animals to justify a digester.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Jeff pointing toward state and or federal programs that might encourage expansion of the size, that might make life easier for the bigger guys in the market.
Yeah. On the specifics of previous grants for the state, I guess I'm not overly well-versed in the specifics on that. The one thing I would say is that at the moment, well, at least historically, what we saw was that demand was increasing both domestically and internationally at a rate that warranted or was able to absorb any additional production that we were able to produce, right? So now as we're in the current situation, we've found that we're kind of maxed out on both of those, on the production side and on the supply side at the moment. So I'd say that's probably at the time that those decisions were made, given the information they had, I could see where they came to those conclusions that they'd want to increase the supply side. But you know, that did obviously bring us to where we are now potentially as well. As far as looking forward at some of these different projects, RNG, renewable natural gas, things like that, what I'm seeing is that a lot of those operations, in order to be run efficiently and able to utilize the new investment to the best of its ability, I'd say your caller's correct that, you know, a lot of those start around that 3,000 cow size, so 3,000 cows and up, in order to make some of those work. So, I think, again, that's kind of back to that natural phenomenon of the consolidation, increased efficiency of the commodity market that we've been experiencing over the last, you know, 50, 100 years, something like this.
Is there any thought that, a group of smaller farmers could take advantage of a subsidy like that for those methane digesters that Jeff was talking about, using, you know, the old-fashioned co-op model? Like, if we add all of our operations together, we hit that I think you said 3,000 head cutoff point?
Yep. So there has been projects like that, and a bunch floated around, that's for sure. I know of one that was in discussions in western Wisconsin that had some additional technical issues to work out before implementation. But I've heard of some down south as well that are looking at doing something like that. And even some that are looking or in the works or discussion of partnering with larger municipalities or other outside organizations that are outside of traditional production agriculture to make something like that happen.
Leonard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Leonard Paulzien, Dairy Markets and Policy Outreach Specialist for UW-Madison's Department of Extension. We've been talking about the dairy industry in Wisconsin and how dairy farmers are reacting to low prices and a glut, a bottleneck, effectively, at dairy processors. Still time for you to share your personal experience if you want. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, the leader of a national anti-hazing group joins us to look at the latest hazing scandal. This one in the Big Ten. Northwestern University's football team coach fired there. And what we can do to prevent hazing from happening in the first place at all levels. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.